Welcome, everybody. It's Chris Walker here with Jerry Hassan. Hello, Jerry.
Hello.
And it's part of Kukubri Book Week podcast. And today we're delighted to have with us Hugh McMillan, very much a local poet, historian, writer, a man of many talents, Hugh, is what you've often been described of. Coming down from the hills of Penpont to Kukubri today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I don't think we have too many hills up there, but...
No, well, I've cycled up there. It felt a bit hilly when I cycled up there. I cycled to Thornhill from here via Penpont.
There is a wee bray.
There is. So, Hugh, we're looking forward to, obviously, next February, March time when we have Kukubri Book Week, and you're appearing there, along with a few others, on the... Let me get the date right. Friday the 3rd of March, the Leaves of the Year. Hugh McMillan, Stuart Patterson, and guest readers in the evening celebrating the life and work of Galloway's greatest modern poet, William Neal. Mm. So, but you are, to some extent, Galloway's modern poet these days. And the book that Jerry has in his hand right now is Macmillan's Galloway, which is, I have a copy here, and it is in our Burns room, and it is probably one of the most read books, Hugh, in there. Tell us, first of all, where this came from.
Well, it was a sort of homage to MacTaggart's Galloway Encyclopedia, which was MacTaggart was this savant born in Borg in the early 19th century, and he was a school refuser kind of thing. He didn't go to school, but somehow later on he got an engineering degree and started building bridges in Canada. I think he could do that kind of thing in the 19th century. But he wrote this amazing sort of book, which I feel is full of lies, MacTaggart's Galloway Encyclopedia. But it's lovely, rich Scots, and it's tales of Galloway, folk tales, tales of his travels, filled with poetry, some of his own poetry and other people's poetry and so on. So the Wigton Book Festival said, could you do a sort of contemporary version of MacTaggart. So my book also is filled with lies.
Jerry, can I just take one bit of it? Because we're going to take you back in time shortly, Hugh, but one of my favourites in here is where we talk about Hornell, obviously, from Kukubri. And you write here, I just wanted to pick you up on it, it said, later in life he produced more formulaic work, emphasising the beauties of rural life. He was a long-time inhabitant of Kukubri, where he found an extensive library on the history of literature at Dumfries and Galloway. As he got older, he took a lot of photographs of small girls, and after he was dead, held a conversation with me in the Selkirk Arms.
Yep. We were here, yeah.
After he was dead?
After he was dead, yeah.
He had a conversation with you?
He did, that's an interview with him, yeah. Beyond the grave.
That's a great interview technique. Maybe we should explore
it's all sorts of
facility
I'll teach you about, Jerry.
Would you?
Well, maybe do that off air.
I think if listeners haven't read Macmillan's Galloway, A Creative Guide by an Unreliable Local, which is a lovely subtitle to it, you must get it, because there's plenty of smiles, laughter, chuckles, and as you say, it bends the truth here and there.
Yeah, and if it leads you to MacTaggart's Galloway Encyclopedia, which is an absolute cult classic as well, You should read that. It's absolutely lovely.
Can I say to you, you probably know this, absolutely knowing this, but it's I love anniversaries, and it's coming up. That was published in 1824, so it's coming up for the 200th anniversary. Any plans to kind of celebrate
there should be a thing, because William Nicholson did that great poem, didn't he, The Brownie of Blenknock in 1828, and he was from Borg also, so... You know, it's kind of little hub of
Borg,
literary excellence hub in the, you know, in the 19th century. Yeah, so it should be a 200th anniversary.
I think you need to do some edition of this to celebrate and mark.
Well, it was meant to come out as a new paperback edition last year, but it never did.
That's Wooth Press, by the way. If you're listening, Gavin McDougall, go with Wooth Press. We need a paperback edition.
Paperback edition, please. Mm-hmm. Hugh,
one of the things that people have never picked up in that book, there's a wee glossary, gazetteer at the back, where people can sort of, with map references for people to find particular places that are mentioned in the book, and one of them's the German Zeppelin base,
Right.
Near Yeah, near Del Rai, but it didn't exist, obviously.
Yeah.
But
I'm thinking there's a little bit
nobody's ever made that pilgrimage to that.
There's a little bit of humour in here, isn't there? And there's a little bit of politics and a little bit of, like, I mean...
Aye. Well, there's, as I say, there's a new edition which brought up to date in certain sort of aspects, like post-referendum stuff and so on.
And the area has more than one Tory MP.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of old-fashioned in some ways, but...
The pub that wasn't in the Wicker Man, you see, the Steam Packet Inn, St Cuthbert's Place, Kirkcudbright, is a lively fisherman's pub. Scenes were shot in the pub and in the alleyway outside, but none made the cut. Did you know that?
No.
As we approach the 50th anniversary of the Wicker Man.
Yeah.
This next year.
That pub seems to have strangely vanished, does it?
The Steam Packet.
Yeah.
It's still there.
It's still there.
Is it just open when it likes?
Exactly. Sort of. Yeah. That's post-COVID, I think that's...
I like that in a pub.
That's just tense of what's happened post-COVID.
I haven't dared to go into it yet since I moved to Kirkcudbright, but I'm building up my courage.
Yeah, yeah. So.
The pub that should have been in the Wicker Man was the Craig Darroch Hotel in Monyive. Is that still on the go?
That's still on the go, yeah.
Good. And the pub that was in the Wicker Man was the Ellen Gown Hotel in Creetown.
Which doesn't exist anymore either.
Doesn't.
No, afraid shut, not shut, yeah.
And that's been a problem, hasn't it? So post-pandemic, I suppose a lot of places have decided to open and close as they... Is it lifestyle? Is it staffing? Is it cost of living? All those things, I think, add up to...
It's a variety of things, isn't it? But, I mean, I do think pubs in villages... A single pub in a village is a really important sort of, you know, thing. The village I come from, Penpunt, the pub shut down 9 years ago. And, you know, if I hadn't... Well, luckily I lived there when the pub was you know, open. Otherwise I would know nobody.
You know,
there'd be no sort of way that you would ever meet anybody, really, apart from
you haven't got a dog,
down,
in other words.
Walking down the road. Or
that's not the way.
Well, you could meet other dog walkers. They're not a very nice breed.
Well, the dog owners.
Yeah, dog owners. Dogs
both,
are great.
Yeah, dogs are great.
Yeah. Well, we've got a dog, you see, and we moved here 14 months ago to Kirkcudbright, and it is just a way of, like, people chat to you, you know.
Yeah. Oh, aye.
Yeah, and so it really, in all seriousness, and I'm a novice dog owner, it's my first ever dog, and it's just great.
Well, I do love dogs, yeah.
Hugh, can we take you back in time? Can you tell us where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Dumfries.
Did you school in Dumfries?
I went to primary and secondary in Dumfries, so I'm a Dumfries boy.
Dunhamer through and through.
I suppose a Dunhamer, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so from school, what happened after school? Where did you go? What?
Went to Edinburgh University, did a history degree, and then towards the end of that, just as I was about to graduate, I had this American... I did American history. I specialised in American history and medieval history, kind of joint honours. And my American tutor got me a job in this newspaper in Philadelphia, right at the bottom rung sort of thing. But yeah. I was all keen to go in that. But circumstances, my mother got ill, and so circumstances dictated that, you know, I didn't go that way. I often wonder what would have happened. If I'd gone to Philadelphia, I might have got run down by a streetcar first day or something like that. You never know, do you?
So what did you do as opposed to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
I went back and became a teacher. I became history teacher.
Okay.
In Dumfries and Galloway, mostly. Mm-hmm. Dumfries Academy and an academy.
And what sort of history do you teach? I mean, what
periods? Well, you've got to teach the curriculum, haven't you?
Yeah.
So,
what was that then?
Modern history... Nowadays a bit of Scottish history, but it's just the Wars of Independence round and round till you're sick. But they do have Scottish history, whereas they didn't when I began,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Except the old grade did have aspects of Scottish history, but.
And when did you start writing, or was that, or were you writing throughout your teaching?
I was kind
career?
Of put off writing at school by my English teacher, who was I'll not say who it was, but who was a professional poet and a really good poet, but a perfectionist. So I remember putting a lot of stock in this poem I'd written about snow falling from a rooftop. I'd done something like 46 versions of it, and I thought it was the best poem ever in the history of the world. I still think it's a lot better than it was received. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was savaged. So that put me off writing poetry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was at Kirkcudbright Academy this morning talking about poetry to the seniors there. And it's funny how in primary schools people are extremely creative, you know, their poems are oozing out of them, doing drawings or running about, you know, poetry is just a natural thing for them. But in secondary school somehow it's kind of either beaten out of them or it's a shameful sort of thing to do, you know, because you're so worried about what your peers think about you and stuff like that, maybe to say you're a poet would like being a shoplifter or something like that.
Now, on these youngsters, I mean, that you've hit a nail on the head. There is this sort of shame thing of people just can't be fully express themselves without being worried what other people are going to think.
Yeah, I suppose it was always thus, though, wasn't it? I mean, although it's exaggerated much more now, because you can get people leaning on you who you don't even know, you know, or who you artificially know. Yeah. You think they're your friends, but you've never met them. But you, nonetheless, you're kind of swayed by their opinions and so on, yeah.
Do you think that you touched on that difference in primary school and secondary school? I've heard that a lot from teachers and people in the education world. Is it something more unique or pronounced in Scotland? Or is it something you think just is a wider thing? Because there's something wonderful about primary school and kids. And
I'm not able to judge what happens in other countries or whether the sort of being a poet is thought of as a more acceptable thing. But I don't know. But certainly in Scotland. But I don't know what it is. It's maybe that whole scared to put your head above the parapet and sort of say here I am, I communicate this way, or it's maybe because they get taught poetry in schools and therefore it becomes part of the routine work and therefore something not to be sort of bothered about, or maybe they just get sick of analysing poetry and things like that. You know, the American poet Billy Collins, he wrote a brilliant poem about, the workshop in which a poem is strapped to a chair and beaten with a rubber hose till it gives out its meaning, kind of thing.
That sounds very Scottish. You know. Or one version of Scottishness, I should say.
No, well, he's
beaten with a rubber hose.
when I'm trying to encourage people to sort of look at poetry and read poetry, he's the go-to man because it's that amazing humour as well. As humour's a great way of bringing in serious issues into stuff, you know.
So, you know, when you were starting to write, was it people like him or who else inspired you and made you think, I want to write?
I was in Dumfries Library one day and I was trying to find the answer to a question in the back of a cheesecake packet, which would win a trip in the Orient Express, right? And I saw this poster on the wall. This was when it was 29, 30, something like that. I saw this poster on the wall advertising the Scottish National Open Poetry Competition, which is now defunct, but which was a brilliant competition. I thought, I'll just have a go at that as well. So I just started writing poetry again.
Wow. And when you go to the likes of Kakuri Academy today, and the difference between the junior school and the senior school to some extent, when you're talking to the seniors about poetry, how are you, what techniques do you use to try and engage them to write poetry?
Well, there are various workshop exercises I use, sort of thing, but the way in is, people just basically do want to communicate and they do want to say things about themselves and they do want to talk in a particularly unique way about the set of circumstances they find themselves in, and some people say teenagers can't write because they don't have the life experience, but that's, a lot of bunkum.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they're asked in their curriculum anyway to do these reflective essays where they kind of look at their past and comment on it and so on. So it's not far from that. It's not a great jump from that to writing poems about their past and so on, So it's quite easy. It's quite easy to find the way in. But as I say, calling yourself a poet or admitting to writing poetry is something that's, a wee bit difficult here in Scotland for some reason.
And you've wrote several books now.
Yeah.
It's one of them you've brought in front of us here. Yep. Are you going to be able to read something from that?
Yes, I shall. Yes, I shall. I should say that we're appearing twice in Kirkcudbright Book Week.
Mm.
It's okay.
That's right.
It's all right.
I've got all my notes.
The Leaves of the Year on Friday, March the 3rd, is to do with Willie Neal, who is, I don't know if you'll know Willie Neal's work, do you, Jenny?
Yeah, but
Willie Neal's this amazing trilingual poet from Cross Michael, originally from Prestwick in Ayrshire, who taught in Castle Douglas High School and lived most of his writing life in Cross Michael. And he wrote in Scots and in Gaelic and in English. And Gaelic was a kind of learned tongue for him. He learned it from scratch. He said, I could not count myself Scottish without learning all the languages of Scotland. And he won the Maud and everything like that. So he wasn't just he was really good at the Gaelic. So there's that commemoration because it's 100th anniversary of his birth this year. Mm-hmm. And so this book's come out where various writers are commenting on what impact Willie had on their lives and their writing
lives
and so on.
You've got a great selection of people on that. You've really done done him proud.
Aye, it's no bad. I mean, there some people didn't bother responding, but I mean, but we've got a lot, a range of people there. Both, you know, Gaz Scott's speakers. Willie Herschel's got a brilliant sort of essay in there. Marcus McInturner from the Gaelic and so on. Yeah, we've got a good,
it's good, looks good.
Good folk in that. Yeah. And on the 28th, we've got four poets coming to entertain you in this Where Rivers Meet. It's spuriously called. I had 30 seconds to come up with a title, so Where Rivers Meet sounds mysterious enough, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even though essentially meaningless. So that's Hugh McMillan, Stuart Patterson, Claire Phillips and Nicola Black. Nicola Black, a writer and a singer, so that would be... That should be very good. Claire Phillips, winner of the Fresh Voice Award in Wigton a couple of years ago, from Dalbeattie, a great writer, and Stuart Patterson, a Scots writer. Yeah.
That'll be a good night. Yeah. That's at the Cookery School, Station House Cookery School, 7 p.m. Tuesday, February the 28th. We'll be recording all these when we get to them as well, Hugh.
Okay, good.
But the idea of today and these podcasts is just to drip ahead of the festival, a little bit of getting to know you and getting to know your poetry.
Okay, well, I'll read you this poem at sea. This is one of the ones I sometimes use with the students as well, using this kind of prompt of remembering things from the past. Not necessarily accurate. You know, you're talking about Milne's Galloway, which is full of the outrageous porky pies. And some of it's factual, some of it's made up, and some of it might be either. You know, it's that kind of...
I love that idea.
Yeah, it's that kind of grey area between, you know, what might be or, you know, what I mean, it'll be, which this poem inhabits. It's about... I was in this seafood restaurant in Oban, and eating away, and I thought to myself, last time I had been in that building was when it was the Fisherman's Mission, and my mother had taken me there. My mother came from Morven, was born in Mull, and we used to go up there all the time. And I remember the last time I was in this place was with my mother, and I was trying to recall what went on. So it's called At Sea. I'm having scallops and Sauvignon Blanc in a restaurant with huge windows, and the sea and sun are throwing light on my face. When I was here with my mother, it was the Fisherman's Mission. The walls were painted dark blue, and she had a long faded coat, not because she was poor, but because she is from the past. Everything is dark blue in the past and half seen. The wallpaper, the pictures with nothing on them, the faces with nothing on them, a tea urn maybe, a giant tea urn, or no tea urn at all. The mind has one go, and the past is stuck there, rinsed by other stuff. Old films, other photos, you or others thinking, it can't have been like that. Probably more like this. At the end, what's left is that colour, dark blue, and my mother saying, this is nice, they help people lost at sea.
Wow. Mm. When you write something like that, Hugh... How do you piece it together? Do you do it in one take? I mean, we've talked to authors who start with a blank canvas, and we had Ian Patrick speaking to us, and he said when he starts a crime novel, he has no idea where it's going.
Well, I don't know. It's a strange mystery.
But on your poetry, you must have an idea.
I don't think I necessarily do. Obviously, I had that idea when I was sitting there. I thought, well, this used to be the Fisherman's Mission. And then, you know, I was just piecing together what I remembered, and I couldn't remember anything, really, apart from
Blue.
My mother. And that's how it came about, you know. Sometimes you look at your poems that you've written and you thought, God, that's really good. And you could have no idea where they come from. You have no idea. Sometimes you look at them and think they're total crap also. And they don't make the cut. But sometimes you sort of... It's a mysterious process, I think. I don't want to romanticise it because poets love to think they're special, very special people. But, you know, sometimes it is a mysterious process which produces something which, you know, you didn't think you were capable of.
Well, that is so interesting because Ian Patrick said nearly identical to us. You know, he's looked back on a book and went, do you know, that's not bad. That's very good.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times he's thinking, no, I'm not sure about that. That's rubbish. How often do you go back? I mean, because you've got a huge back catalogue, as it were, of poetry. How often do you go back over them?
Well, stuff that have been published. You know, sometimes you look at. I have looked at previous books, and I thought I could have done that a lot better now if I'd been doing that sort of thing. You know, So you do have this feeling you need to get into print, and sometimes maybe you go into print a bit quicker than then you should. But then, you know, you don't want to sit in things, you want to get them out there.
Yeah. Do you go back ever and look back at your early stuff and go, well, I could have really polished up Love Me Do a little bit better if
Definitely, because I mean, I read from a few of my books, four or five of my books, when I go into readings and festivals and things like this, and you know, the copies I've got that I read out of are corrected kind of thing. So I'm kind of revising them as I've gone along, but I mean, yeah. So yeah, sometimes you see things which are just blatantly no right, you know.
Anything you wouldn't write a poem on, by the way?
No, I don't.
Dangerous subject. That's
a good question, Jerry.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't write a poem about something that was deliberately meant to be offensive to somebody.
Yeah.
Or hurt somebody personally or a group of people. You know, I wouldn't want to do that. No. I did feel the whole thing about the, it's probably quite controversial, but the whole thing about the Queen's death and the funeral of the Queen, I felt that there was tremendous orthodoxy being forced down people's throats there.
Yeah.
And the major poetical figures who responded to that, you know, the Scottish Marker, Simon Armitage, Roger McGough, produced really kind of anodyne, formulaic, puff stuff, you know, which, you know, was forming, you know, following the orthodox line. And I did feel that, you know, it's poetry's job to challenge things.
I know.
I feel, and to represent other views. But, you know, that was very disappointing to me, that people felt compelled. I mean, nobody's celebrating an old lady's death or anything like that, but what she stood for that, you know, should perhaps have been sort of challenged.
I mean, official narratives as poetry doesn't really work, does it?
That's what happened. You know, people who you can understand, I suppose, how the poet laureate feels compelled to,
of course,
to follow the party line. But, you know, folk like Roger McGough didn't have to do it.
I know. I mean, I think lots of things, I mean, everything nearly to an extent, depending on how you do it, is ripe of satire and comedy and imagination. Yeah. And, you know, we live in Dumfries and Galway, I'm going to say it very cautiously and carefully, we have, as a blessing, we have as our MP, you know, a man called Alistair Jack, who's our Secretary of State for Scotland. Whatever your politics, that's a subject ripe for some satire. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a way to be raptured into the House of Lords. He's a MP that is a way to be, you know, taken into the next level. Oh, that's worthy of some great poetry.
Well, you have Alan McClure appearing, don't you, on Thursday, March the 2nd, so you must ask him to sing his song about Alistair Jack.
Right. Has he got a song?
I wrote a letter to Alistair Jack, but Alistair Jack, he didn't write back. Oh, yes, he's a busy man. And, you know, it's like that. It's a great song.
Because he doesn't reply to many people. My other half, through, you know, the various versions of Boris Johnson's moral descent, my other half wrote him three letters and got back three replies. I mean, it'd be standard letters, I guess, in a way. Yeah. That they had. But you got back three replies, because most people, or lots of people anyway, don't get replies. So, you know, some result.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, here's one from your Macmillan's Galloway. Thomas Carlyle once told Queen Victoria that the most inspirational road in Scotland was the road from Carsleuth to Cretown. This is not true. For inspiration, the exotic insights into life, that road, lovely though it is when the tide's in and the sun shining silver on the waters of the Solway and on the battlements of romantic ruined castle, pales into insignificance when compared to the A76 trunk road from Hollywood to Kirkconnell.
Yeah,
I don't know if the Queen ever went on that road. But
more poets along that road, yeah.
There are, you've mentioned them along here.
Poor old Thomas Carlyle is a great Dumfries and Galloway figure, isn't he? I remember being involved in some attempt to have a Thomas Carlyle festival based in Annan, but obviously that was going nowhere. Do you know what I mean? Hitler's bedside book, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Frederick the Great by Thomas Carlyle.
Goebbels
used to read them excerpts.
Somebody said last week he did read the Beveridge Report, which is translated to German. You read a lot, you know.
he was an Eccle Feckin lad, wasn't he, Thomas Carlyle?
He was a Feckin lad.
Yeah, he was a Feckin lad indeed.
Yeah.
Festival wise, Hugh, I mean, I know you appear quite often at Wheaton Book Festival.
Yep.
Kirkcudbright Book Festival is great.
Yep.
What about outside of Dumfries and Galloway? Do you
well, I'm just
to
down from Mallaig. There was in the right wee Highland Hooley, it's called. It was a book festival up there. So appeared there and did a workshop with Mallaig High School with the seniors up there as well.
Excellent.
prior to that, Stonehaven, same sort of thing. I like to have the outreach with the schools as well as events in the festival sort of thing. Certain festivals have never asked me. The Edinburgh Book Festival has never asked me, for instance, but.
We could change that, maybe, Jerry.
Take that. Given
I think that's a reflection on them rather than me.
Well, given they're going to have to be looking to their laurels next year, you know, with the cuts they're facing, maybe you could think about that Edinburgh International Book Festival.
Definitely. because they podcast as well, don't they? They'll be listening to ours now, Jerry. Surely.
Somebody in today's Times, it's inaccurate. They're writing about the demise of Edinburgh International Book Fest. That's how they've described it. I think that's a little bit of an overstatement. So I think that is, not so.
So where else? Kakubri coming up next year. Anything else on the horizon?
Next year, well, they've got a project in New York about Anne and Sandstone. Which was taken across as ballast and ships. This is inspired by the artist Hugh Bryden. I don't know if you know Hugh Bryden. He lives in Dumfries. And great artist in that right, but also he does artist books with poets in Roncadora Press. Mm-hmm. Recently won the Saltire with Donald Murray for a book, Ach and Alt. So he's a great inventive, creative force, Hugh Bryden. So this is his idea. So I'm going along in his coattails because he wanted a poet. But the idea was Anne and Sandstone was taken as ballast and ships across to America and was then used for various projects in America. And one of them was the Capitol building in New York State, Albany, has this thing called the Million Dollar Staircase, which is created from Anne and Sandstone. And masons from this area, but also Italian masons, carved faces on these stairs, right? And faces of famous people, faces when they ran out of that, faces of relatives, passers-by in the street and stuff like this. So the idea was to create a project round that, using, you know, a poet from the Dumfries and Galloway, a poet from New York, a musician, an artist from New York, an artist from the Dumfries and Galloway, and so on. So he's just been across to New York, and I'm going in February, so that's something for next year.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
And how is that? Would that be your first time, sort of, in the States, or have you been?
No, I've been to New York a few times, but I mean, not just on my own bat, sort of thing. Not anything to do with, you know, my craft.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it's Scottish literature and poetry, etc. I suspect it will be fairly well received in New York.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm sure that's true, but I'll tell you better when I've read poetry in New York, because I've never done that.
Yeah, because we get a lot of Americans come here in the summer, mainly tracing their roots, coming to Kakubri. There's quite a lot of McClellans out there on the East Coast coming across a McClellan Castle. Sort of disappointed that it's a ruin and not got heat and light inside it as the family home. Yeah. But nevertheless, they love the connection to Scotland. So I think you will be well received.
There's Tartan Day, as I think it's, I'm not sure it's still called Tartan Day, if it could change to Scotland Day. And there's all these St Andrews societies, and some of them, you know, they have a certain mythical. Idea. Like, not quite a Brigadoon version of Scotland, but it's a version of Scotland that isn't quite the modern Scotland.
I've certainly experienced that, because I am, a little known fact is, I am the official bard of the Clan Macmillan.
Oh.
Right, and George Macmillan, who is the chief of the Clan Macmillan, who lives in Finlayson House, opposite Dumbarton, and he has this, or used to have pre-COVID anyway, this gathering where people would come and toss the cable and stuff like this, and lots of Americans would come along, and George would take them off to, I hope George isn't going to listen to this, George would take them off to some chapel in the wilds and knight them with this fantastic sword he'd made, right? And then they would come back quite cheery that they'd been, you know,
knighted,
brought into the Highland family.
So that's
a ritual you went through?
No, I never went through that noise. That's just for paying guests.
straight to bar.
No, I just went along and read some poetry and drank the whiskey.
Oh, good. Well, Hugh, thank you so much for joining us. As I say, these podcasts, we're going to drip them out ahead of Kakubri Book Week, which is next February and March 2023. But it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you for bringing along, reading some poetry. Thank you for letting us delve into Macmillan's Galloway as well, a creative guide by an unreliable local. Still love that subtitle. And We will see you at the book festival. Good luck in America in February. Yeah, because it'll be hot off the heels.
I'll be in Kirkcudbright before I'm in America.
Oh, Kirkcudbright here first, and then it's off to America. Yeah. Great. Okay, Hugh McMillan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. Pubs in villages, a single pub in a village is a really important sort of, you know, thing. The village I come from, Penpunt, the pub shut down 9 years ago. And, you know, if I hadn't, well, luckily I lived there when the pub was you know, open. Otherwise I would know nobody. You know, there'd be no sort of way that you would ever meet anybody, really, apart from
you got a dog
down,
in other words.
Walking down the road. Or
that's not the way.
Well, you could meet other dog walkers. They're not a very nice breed.
Well, the dog owners.
Yeah, dog owners. Dogs
both,
are great.
Yeah, dogs are great.
Yeah. Well, we've got a dog, you see, and we moved here 14 months ago to Kirkcudbright, and it is just a way of, like, people chat to you, you know. Yeah.
Oh, aye.
Yeah, and so, and really, in all seriousness, and I'm a novice dog owner, our first ever dog, and it's just great.
Well, I do love dogs, yeah.
Hugh, can we take you back in time? Can you tell us where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Dumfries.
Did you school in Dumfries?
I went to primary and secondary in Dumfries, so I'm a Dumfries boy.
Dunhamer through and through.
I suppose a Dunhamer, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so from school, what happened after school? Where did you go? What?
Went to Edinburgh University, did a history degree, and then towards the end of that, just as I was about to graduate, I had this American... I did American history. I specialised in American history and medieval history, kind of joint honours. And my American tutor got me a job in this newspaper in Philadelphia, right at the bottom rung sort of thing. But yeah. I was all keen to go in that. But circumstances, my mother got ill, and so circumstances dictated that, you know, I didn't go that way. I often wonder what would have happened. If I'd gone to Philadelphia, I might have got run down by a streetcar first day or something like that. You never know, do you?
So what did you do as opposed to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
I went back and became a teacher. I became history teacher.
Okay.
In Dumfries and Galloway, mostly. Mm-hmm. Dumfries Academy, Ion Academy.
And what sort of history do you teach? I mean, what
periods? Well, you've got to teach the curriculum, haven't you?
Yeah.
So,
what was that then?
Modern history. Nowadays a bit of Scottish history, but it's just the Wars of Independence round and round till you're sick. But they do have Scottish history, whereas they didn't when I began,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Except the old grade did have aspects of Scottish history, but.
And when did you start writing, or was that, or were you writing throughout your teaching?
I was kind
career?
Of put off writing at school by my English teacher, who was I'll not say who it was, but who was a professional poet and a really good poet, but a perfectionist. So I remember putting a lot of stock in this poem I'd written about snow falling from a rooftop. I'd done something like 46 versions of it, and I thought it was the best poem ever in the history of the world. I still think it's a lot better than it was received. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was savaged. So that put me off writing poetry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was at Kirkcudbright Academy this morning talking about poetry to the seniors there. And it's funny how in primary schools people are extremely creative, you know, their poems are oozing out of them, doing drawings or running about, you know, poetry is just a natural thing for them. But in secondary school somehow it's kind of either beaten out of them or it's a shameful sort of thing to do, you know, because you're so worried about what your peers think about you and stuff like that. To say you're a poet would
be
a shoplifter or something like that.
Now. On these youngsters, I mean, that you've hit a nail on the head. There is this sort of shame thing of people just can't be fully express themselves without being worried what other people are going to think.
Yeah, I suppose it was always thus, though, wasn't it? I mean, although it's exaggerated much more now because you can get people leaning on you who you don't even know, you know, or who you artificially know. Yeah. You think they're your friends, but you've never met them. But you're, nonetheless, you're swayed by their opinions and so on. Yeah.
Do you think that you touched on that difference in primary school and secondary school? I've heard that a lot from teachers and people in the education world. Is it something more unique or pronounced in Scotland? Is it something you think just is a wider thing? Because there's something wonderful about primary school and kids. And
I'm not able to judge what happens in other countries or whether the sort of being a poet is thought of as a more acceptable thing. But I don't know. But certainly in Scotland. But I don't know what it is. It's maybe that whole scared to put your head above the parapet and sort of say here I am, I communicate this way, or it's maybe because they get taught poetry in schools and therefore it becomes part of the routine work and therefore something not to be sort of bothered about, or maybe they just get sick of analysing poetry and things like that. The American poet Billy Collins, he wrote a brilliant poem about the workshop in which a poem is strapped to a chair and beaten with a rubber hose till it gives out its meaning, kind of thing.
That sounds very Scottish. Or one version of Scottishness, I should say.
He's
beaten with a rubber hose.
He's great. When I'm trying to encourage people to sort of look at poetry and read poetry, he's the go-to man because it's that amazing humour as well. As humour's a great way of bringing in serious issues into stuff,
So, when you were starting to write, was it people like him or who else inspired you and made you think, I want to write?
I was in Dumfries Library one day and I was trying to find the answer to a question in the back of a cheesecake packet, which would win a trip in the Orient Express, right? And I saw this poster on the wall. This was when it was 29, 30, something like that. I saw this poster on the wall advertising the Scottish National Open Poetry Competition, which is now defunct, but which was a brilliant competition. I thought, I'll just have a go at that as well. So I just started writing poetry again.
Wow. And when you go to the likes of Kakuri Academy today, and the difference between the junior school and the senior school to some extent, when you're talking to the seniors about poetry, how are you, what techniques do you use to try and engage them to write poetry?
Well, there are various workshop exercises I use, sort of thing, but the way in is, people just basically do want to communicate and they do want to say things about themselves and they do want to talk in a particularly unique way about the set of circumstances they find themselves in, and some people say teenagers can't write because they don't have the life experience, but that's, a lot of bunkum.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're asked in their curriculum anyway to do these reflective essays where they kind of look at their past and comment on it and so on. So it's not far from that. It's not a great jump from that to writing poems about their past and so on, So it's quite easy. It's quite easy to find the way in. But as I say, calling yourself a poet or admitting to writing poetry is something that's, a wee bit difficult here in Scotland for some reason.
And you've wrote several books now.
Yeah.
It's one of them you've brought in front of us here. Yep. Are you going to be able to read something from that?
Yes, I shall. Yes, I shall. I should say that we're appearing twice in Kirkcudbright Book Week.
Mm.
It's okay.
That's right.
It's all right.
I've got all my notes.
The Leaves of the Year on Friday, March the 3rd, is to do with Willie Neal, who is, I don't know if you'll know Willie Neal's work, do you, Jenny?
Yeah,
but Willie Neal's this amazing trilingual poet from Cross Michael, originally from Prestwick in Ayrshire, who taught in Castle Douglas High School and lived most of his writing life in Cross Michael. And he wrote in Scots and in Gaelic and in English. And Gaelic was a kind of learned tongue for him. He learned it from scratch. He said, I could not count myself Scottish without learning all the languages of Scotland. And he won the Maud and everything like that. So he wasn't just he was really good at the Gaelic. So there's that commemoration because it's 100th anniversary of his birth this year. Mm-hmm. And so this book's come out where various writers are commenting on what impact Willie had on their lives and their writing lives and so on.
You've got a great selection of people on that. You've really done them proud.
Ah, it's no bad. I mean, some people didn't bother responding, but we've got a range of people there, both, Scots speakers. Willie Herschel's got a brilliant sort of essay in there. Marcus McInturner from the Gaelic and so on. Yeah, we've got good folk in that, yeah. And on the 28th, we've got four poets coming to entertain you in this Where Rivers Meet. It's spuriously called. I had 30 seconds to come up with a title, so Where Rivers Meet sounds mysterious enough, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even though essentially meaningless. So that's Hugh McMillan, Stuart Patterson, Claire Phillips and Nicola Black. Nicola Black, a writer and a singer, so that would be, that should be very good. Claire Phillips, winner of the Fresh Voice Award in Wigton a couple of years ago, from Dalbeattie, a great writer, and Stuart Patterson, a Scots writer. Yeah.
That'll be a good night. Yeah. That's at the Cookery School, Station House Cookery School, 7 p.m. Tuesday, February the 28th. We'll be recording all these when we get to them as well, Hugh.
Okay, good.
But the idea of today and these podcasts is just to drip ahead of the festival, a little bit of getting to know you and getting to know your poetry.
Okay. Well, I'll read you this poem at sea. This is one of the ones I sometimes use with the students as well, using this kind of prompt of remembering things from the past. Not necessarily accurate. You know, you're talking about Milne's Galloway, which is full of the outrageous porky pies. And some of it's factual, some of it's made up, and some of it might be either. You know, it's that kind of...
I love that idea.
Yeah, it's that kind of grey area between, you know, what might be or, you know, what I mean, it'll be, which this poem inhabits. It's about... I was in this seafood restaurant in Oban and eating away, and I thought to myself, last time I had been in that building was when it was the Fisherman's Mission, and my mother had taken me there. My mother came from Morve and was born in Mull, and we used to go up there all the time. And I remember the last time I was in this place was with my mother, and I was trying to recall what went on. So it's called At Sea. I'm having scallops and Sauvignon Blanc in a restaurant with huge windows, and the sea and sun are throwing light on my face. When I was here with my mother, it was the Fisherman's Mission. The walls were painted dark blue, and she had a long faded coat, not because she was poor, but because she is from the past. Everything is dark blue in the past and half seen. The wallpaper, the pictures with nothing on them, the faces with nothing on them, a tea urn maybe, a giant tea urn, or no tea urn at all. The mind has one go, and the past is stuck there, rinsed by other stuff, old films, other photos, you or others thinking, it can't have been like that, probably more like this. At the end, what's left is that colour, dark blue, and my mother saying, this is nice. They help people lost at sea.
Wow. Mm. When you write something like that, Hugh, how do you piece it together? Do you do it in one take? I mean, we've talked to authors who start with a blank canvas, and we had Ian Patrick speaking to us, and he said when he starts a crime novel, he has no idea where it's going.
Well, I don't know. It's a strange mystery.
But on your poetry, you must have an idea when
I don't think I necessarily do. Obviously, I had that idea when I was sitting there. I thought, well, this used to be the Fisherman's Mission. Mm. And then, you know, I was just piecing together what I remembered, and I couldn't remember anything, really, apart from
Blue,
my mother. And that's how it came about, you know. Sometimes you look at your poems that you've written, and you thought, God, that's really good. And you could have no idea where they come from. You have no idea. Sometimes you look at them and think that. Total crap also, and they don't make the cut, but sometimes you sort of, it's a mysterious process, I think. I don't want to romanticise it, because poets love to think they're special, very special people, but, you know, sometimes it is a mysterious process which produces something which, you know, you didn't think you were capable of.
Well, that is so interesting, because Ian Patrick said nearly identical to us. You know, he's looked back on a book and went, do you know, that's not bad. That's very good.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times you think, no, I'm not sure about that. That's rubbish. How often do you go back? I mean, because you've got a huge back catalogue, as it were, of poetry. How often do you go back over them?
Well, stuff that have been published, you know, sometimes you look at... I have looked at previous books and I thought, I could have done that a lot better now if I'd been doing that sort of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So you do have this feeling you need to get into print, and sometimes maybe you go into print a bit quicker than you should, but then, you know, you don't want certain things, you want to get them out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah,
Do you go back ever and look back at your early stuff and go, well, I could have really polished up Love Me Do a little bit better if I'd known what my craft was? Or...
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Because, I mean, I read from a few of my books, four or five of my books, when I go into readings and festivals and things like this. And, you know, the copies I've got that I read out of are corrected kind of thing.
Oh, right,
so,
right.
So I'm kind of revising them I've gone along. But, I mean, yeah. So, yeah. Sometimes you see things which are just blatantly no right, you know.
Anything you wouldn't write a poem on, by the way?
No, I don't.
Dangerous subject, that's
a good question, Jerry.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't write a poem about something that was deliberately meant to be offensive to somebody.
Yeah.
Or hurt somebody personally or a group of people. You know, I wouldn't want to do that, no. I did feel the whole thing about the, it's probably quite controversial, but the whole thing about the Queen's death and the funeral of the Queen, I felt that there was tremendous orthodoxy being forced down people's throats there.
Yeah.
And the major poetical figures who responded to that, you know, the Scottish Marker, Simon Armitage, Roger McGough, produced really kind of anodyne, formulaic, puff stuff, you know, which, you know, was forming, you know, following the orthodox line. And I did feel that, you know, it's poetry's job to challenge things.
I know.
I feel, and to represent other views. But, you know, that was very disappointing to me, that people felt compelled. I mean, nobody's celebrating an old lady's death or anything like that, but what she stood for that, you know, should perhaps have been sort of challenged.
I mean, official narratives as poetry doesn't really work, does it?
That's what happened. You know, people who you can understand, I suppose, how the poet laureate feels compelled to,
of course,
to follow the party line. But, you know, folk like Roger McGough didn't have to do it.
I know. I mean, I think lots of things, I mean, everything nearly to an extent, depending on how you do it, is ripe of satire and comedy and imagination. Yeah. And, you know, we live in Dumfries and Galway, I'm going to say it very cautiously and carefully, we have, as a blessing, we have as our MP, you know, a man called Alistair Jack, who's our Secretary of State for Scotland. Whatever your politics, that's a subject ripe for some satire. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a way to be raptured into the House of Lords. He's a MP that is a way to be, you know, taken into the next level. Oh, that's worthy of some great poetry.
Well, you have Alan McClure appearing, don't you, on Thursday, March the 2nd, so you must ask him to sing his song about Alistair Jack.
Right. Has he got a song?
I wrote a letter to Alistair Jack, but Alistair Jack, he didn't write back. Oh, yes, he's a busy man. And, you know, it's like that. It's a great song.
Because he doesn't reply to many people. My other half, through, you know, the various versions of Boris Johnson's moral descent, my other half wrote him three letters and got back three replies. I mean, it'd be standard letters, I guess, in a way. Yeah. That they had. But he got back three replies because most people, or lots of people anyway, don't get replies. So, you know, some result.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, here's one from your Macmillan's Galloway. Thomas Carlyle once told Queen Victoria that the most inspirational road in Scotland was the road from Carsluth to Cretown. This is not true. For inspiration, the exotic insights into life, that road, lovely though it is when the tide's in and the sun shining silver on the waters of the Solway and on the battlements of romantic ruined castle, pales into insignificance when compared to the A76 trunk road from Hollywood to Kirkconnell.
Yeah,
I don't know if the Queen ever went on that road. But
more poets along that road, yeah.
There are, you've mentioned them along here.
Poor old Thomas Carlyle is a great Dumfries and Galloway figure, isn't he? I remember being involved in some attempt to have a Thomas Carlyle festival based in Annan, but obviously that was going nowhere. Do you know what I mean? Hitler's bedside book, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Frederick the Great by Thomas Carlyle.
Well, he did read the one in Ecclefechan.
Goebbels used to read him excerpts.
Somebody said last week he did read the Beveridge Report, which was translated to German. He read a lot, you know.
he was an Ecclefechan lad, wasn't he, Thomas Carlyle?
He was a Feckin lad.
Yeah, he was a Feckin lad indeed.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have to pause that there, two ticks.
This is a beautiful book, by the way.